coming up on this edition of the Black Vault Radio. Investigative journalist and author Jefferson Morley steps into the vault to talk about his research into the JFK assassination and whether or not the conspiracies that surround that fateful day on November 22, 1963 have any truth.
The CIA has something to hide here. They have something they don't want to share. Oswald was under male surveillance starting in November 1959. Trump also gave the CIA and FBI permission to continue withholding a huge amount of material. According to the president's orders, we won't see until 2021. If they rolled the president twice in 6 months and got away with it, why wouldn't that happen again?
All that and much more. So stay tuned. The Black Vault Radio is about to begin. More than 20 years ago, I began a journey, my quest for the truth. My name is John Greenwald, and I have hammered the United States government with Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get answers. I have more than 2 million pages of declassified documents for you to download at theblackvault.com. Now, I attempt to dive even deeper and talk to some of the most brilliant minds on this planet. No government secret is off limits, and no question is off the table. All I aim for is the truth. This is the Black Vault Radio. That's right, everybody. This is the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know, and I've said it before, but I know that there are millions of options out there of various podcasts, radio shows, and all sorts of streaming audio channels. I'm very excited that you guys chose this one to at least listen to. I think you're going to be not let down. It's going to be a great episode. We are talking to journalist Jefferson Morley, and we are diving deep into his research into the JFK assassination. So we're switching it up a little bit from previous episodes here on the Black Vault Radio. So Jefferson has been a journalist for over 30 years. He has worked for the Washington Post for about 15 of those years, including a long list of various publications that he has worked for in the past and is currently working for. He has a heck of a resume, quite a few books to his name. I'll be naming all of them in his particular segment when he joins me in the TBV Dialogue segment coming up in just a little bit. Now, first, a couple of quick announcements before we get to the news. Now, thank you all for subscribing to this particular radio show, whether it be on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, whatever your podcast aggregator of choice is. Thank you for that. But I wanted to give you kind of a quick invite, because it leads into a new segment that is going to premiere in this specific episode, and that is the TBV Mailbag. Now, for those of you who have subscribed to the Black Vault, whether it be on Facebook or Twitter, you saw my announcement that Jefferson Morley would be joining me in this week's episode. What I did was asked you to submit your questions. That's the TBV Mailbag segment, where I take myself out of the interview, open up the mailbag, and ask that week, that episode's guest, the TBV Mailbag questions. Those are all that come from you. I was pretty excited, because I've never talked about that I was doing this, pretty excited by the feedback that I did get and the submissions that were emailed in. Some anonymous, some with names attached. That's up to you if you want to be shouted out on the show or not. But the TBV Mailbag, the entire purpose is to allow you guys and gals to submit your questions and be a part of the show. In order to do that, though, I only announce it on those social media platforms. So I will link all of the specific links in the show notes page. If you do not know how to get it and get there, and I would highly recommend that you bookmark this page. Go to www.theblackvault.com/show notes. What that page does is break down every single episode of the Black Vault Radio. This specifically, you are listening to episode number 5. go ahead and log on to that page, find episode number 5. It will link all of the pertinent pages that we talk about in all the various segments of the show. For example, the news headlines will all be linked. The social network platforms that I just referenced will all be linked. Jefferson's homepage when he comes on, and all the various documents and different topics that we talk about. I'll throw some links in there so it will allow you to take the next step past this interview, because there's going to be a lot of information. And Jefferson's got a great website. It's jfkfacts.org. Definitely log on to that. But I'll link it all on those show notes pages. And so make sure you do bookmark it. That way it gives you the show links, gives you the show itself, and how to, again, research a little bit more. So that would be, again, www.theblackvault.com/show notes, and that will break down everything. As I mentioned, Jefferson Morley is my guest. We are talking about all things JFK assassination. My guess is we'll probably get into quite a bit more. Jefferson is an encyclopedia of knowledge, so you will not be let down at this episode. Before we bring him on, we're going to deal with some headlines on TBV News. In this episode's TBV News segment, I want to deal with a few headlines that you may or may not have seen here since our last episode. Now, the first story that I want to talk about comes out of Fox 25 from Boston. Headline being, FBI releases declassified Carter Page FISA applications. Now, if you're not familiar with what FISA applications or FISA warrants are, quite simply put, they are for watching potential spies here in America. This was established and authorized under what was called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's where FISA comes from. And they are managed by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And these are pretty hard to come by, meaning these particular warrants are highly classified and deal with things that the government just straight out doesn't want to talk about. I've gone after warrants myself. I've been able to get quite a few declassified, although they are heavily redacted. The Edward Snowden leaks shed kind of some new light on the FISA court process and the warrants that came along with it. They are mostly given to the NSA and the FBI when they want to watch specific people. Now, this particular declassification was a FISA warrant on Carter Page. Now, if you're not familiar with who Carter Page is, he was the founder of what is called the Global Energy Capital Company, which is, as defined on his profile page, a one-man investment fund and consulting firm specializing in the Russian and Central Asian oil and gas business. Now, in true government style, they actually declassified this and released it on a Saturday. Now, for those who aren't really aware of why would they release this on a Saturday, well, simply put, that's when news cycles slow down. Obviously, through Monday through Friday, that's really when people watch the news. Weekends, you're kind of falling off, so you don't really pay attention as much as you do Monday through Friday. And normally, you'll see document dumps by the U.S. government on a Friday evening, or in this particular case, a Saturday. Now, this particular warrant was classified top secret. It is heavily redacted. Not much was released. However, you can glean from it quite a few different things. Here's one particular, two particular excerpts from the document. Again, with the redactions, makes it a little bit hard to understand fully and grasp, but you can definitely read between the lines and understand that Carter Page was under surveillance for his connections and possibly Russian connections with the intent of swaying the 2016 election. This first excerpt reads, "The FBI believes that the Russian government's efforts are being coordinated with Page and perhaps other individuals associated with candidate number one's campaign." Now, who is candidate number one? Well, you can actually determine that by the second excerpt that I'll read. "This application targets Carter Page. The FBI believes Page has been the subject of targeted recruitment by the Russian government." Then there's a line and a half that's fully redacted. Then it says, "Undermine and influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election in violation of U.S. criminal law. Page is a former foreign policy advisor to a candidate for U.S. president and, in parentheses, candidate number one. Well, we all know that Carter Page worked with Donald Trump, so we can easily deduce candidate number one is Donald Trump. That being said, the document goes on. It's actually over 400 pages in this specific warrant. They declassified it, released it on Saturday. I will link it in the show notes, but it is something to definitely take a look at, especially for those who are following this developing story. Doesn't matter what side of the aisle you sit on. I'm not trying to make this political, but this is kind of getting a little bit interesting. People that are close to the president with these ties to Russia, it makes you do question a little bit about President Trump's connection to any of this, if at all. Now, again, not trying to be political with bringing up this story, but rather it is interesting because it's the Freedom of Information Act that's actually bringing this material out. The U.S. government does not want to talk about it. The FISA warrants are very hard to get a hold of. But with the public's interest and demand under the Freedom of Information Act, they released this on Saturday night. So definitely take a look at that in the show notes. Another story I want to talk about, this one comes from nextgov.com. This is a news website that deals with all things military and U.S. military and U.S. government. And this particular one, which actually gained quite a bit of traction through multiple news agencies, is about an agency that is called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. Now, DARPA really is involved with some crazy stuff. And if you're not familiar with them, I'll link to their homepage so you can kind of get a little bit of an idea. I'll be honest with you, they have really sugarcoated some very scary projects that they have undertaken. One specific one that I want to bring up, because these headlines that just came about here in the last week, week and a half, is all about DARPA's research into mind control technology. Now, to preface this news story that just surfaced, I want to actually backtrack to 2013. And this was a project from a leaked document. I don't like leaked documents. I don't really have a whole lot of faith in them, nor do I really follow them. But it seemed like this particular leak that was first published by a site called Activist Post held a little bit of truth to it. And that was about a DARPA project involved in mind control research and, in essence, bridging computers and the human brain. Now, if you don't think that that sounds a little bit like science fiction, I'm not sure what does, but the truth behind it is it actually was real. I filed a FOIA request to DARPA and the Department of Defense and even the Department of Interior, and they all had documents on what was a contract that was awarded to Arizona State University, and they nicknamed it N2. And I actually received all of the awards that were given to ASU, including all of the phase one progress reports, which gives the status, and every quarter ASU had created these kind of updates for DARPA. I was able to obtain all of those under the FOIA, including additional contracts from the Department of Interior that all tied into this N2. So when I saw another headline about DARPA and mind control, my curiosity was piqued, and sure enough, this is not a leaked document anymore. This is actually something that's going on. And according to nextgov.com, they explain the project such as this. Quote, the next generation non-surgical neurotechnology, or N3, program aims to combine the speed and processing power of computers with humans' ability to adapt to complex situations, DARPA said. In other words, the technology would let people control, feel, and interact with a remote machine as though it were part of their own body. That is from the nextgov.com article, obviously quoting DARPA in that. That's some scary stuff. There's been some shows that I've worked on in television production that deal with artificial intelligence. And even though in these specific episodes, it talked a little bit about kind of the connection to an alien race, that if we do make contact, most likely it will be with an artificial intelligence. But in the process of creating these documentaries, it is scary on what really artificial intelligence is capable of. But then when you start bridging computer chips to the human mind, that artificial intelligence can actually then utilize that computer power, that processing power, link it into the mind, and then therefore that kind of leads into that mind control that you can then, in essence, take over someone's brain. Now, obviously, DARPA is not trying to do that specific thing with this program. However, they are doing that type of technology. And so it really makes you wonder, is this truly what they are trying to do and accomplish? Because DARPA really seemingly tries to sugarcoat a lot of what they do. When I researched N2, on the surface, sounds pretty cool and interesting science, but at the root of it, it's scary. And now, obviously, that research is continuing with what they're calling N3, this just out in the last week and a half. So it really makes you wonder exactly what these guys are doing. Last headline I want to talk about here before we move on to my interview with Jefferson Morley comes out of Sky 7 News in Buffalo, New York. This is an ABC affiliate. And this is for all you paranormal fans out there. I love stuff like this when it happens on live television. Apparently, this news station in Buffalo, WKBW or ABC7 in Buffalo, New York, they were doing a weather report. And they were doing some time-lapse sunset on their nightly news program. And as they were doing these time-lapse backgrounds to the weather report, this newscaster and I'm assuming the editor, they see this UFO appear in the clouds during this time-lapse photography. And that's kind of interesting because she kind of points it out. I'll link to the video in the show notes. She points it out on screen. And, you know, I mean, I didn't think much of it as I'm watching this. Somebody had sent it to me in my mailbox. And I look at it, it's a light in the sky, it looks like a plane. So I'm thinking, okay, well, wow, they're trying to make a big story out of a light in the sky. And then as she backs away, she says, I'm going to get out because it happens quick. She backs out of the frame and then they play the time lapse. And you see this thing not only appear from the clouds, but then actually shoot straight forward towards the camera and fly off screen. Comes, I mean, relatively close. It's kind of hard to determine because it's time lapse, but it comes straight forward towards the camera, then goes off, obviously, behind the field of view of the camera, and off it goes. All happens very, very quickly. The newscaster put in her 2 cents that she thinks it's a drone. She probably shouldn't have said that because it doesn't really look like a drone. On top of that, it kind of has no physical structure when you kind of pause it when it gets towards the camera. It just looks like a light in the sky. Now, a helicopter that maybe by chance that was the flight line, a plane, or even a drone, it wouldn't only capture the light. The light does not fully engulf a physical object like a drone, an airplane, or a helicopter. It takes a lot to intrigue me when it comes to UFO sightings. This specific one, I'll give it that. It actually is fairly intriguing because you don't really see this that often. And ABC7 there in Buffalo, New York, decided to put it in one of their segments. Hey, pretty cool. Good on them for at least profiling it. They tried to dismiss it as a drone. I don't believe that that's what this specific thing is. But log on to the show notes, theblackvault.com/show notes. Look under the TBV News segment heading for episode number 5. That's what you're listening to. I'll link over to the video, let you guys decide, but it was definitely worth a mention because stuff like that is pretty darn cool, especially when they catch it on accident. These aren't UFO hunters. It's just an ABC News channel, and they happen to catch something very cool. That being said, it is time for me to welcome Jefferson Morley onto the program where we dive deep into all things JFK assassination. Stay tuned for the TBV Dialogue segment. On this episode's TBV Dialogue segment, I welcome Jefferson Morley to the show. Jefferson's a journalist and editor who has worked in Washington journalism for over 30 years, 15 of which were spent as an editor and reporter at the Washington Post. He's also written for Salon, The New Republic, Arms Control Today, Alternet, and The Intercept. He's the author of Our Man in Mexico, a biography of the CIA's Mexico City Station Chief, Winston Scott. The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Angleton. Snowstorm in August, Washington City, Francis Scott Key, and the Forgotten Race Riot of 1835. And, pertaining to this show, CIA and JFK, The Secret Assassination Files. All books very much up my alley, so I would highly recommend you all to check them out. They're all purchasable on Amazon and a bookstore near you. Jefferson, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. You have an extensive history to investigating quite a few things, most notably the JFK assassination. Your website for all those listening is www.jfkfacts.org. I highly recommend everyone to check it out. It's the F word that I really like on this show, which is the fact that you really ultimately fact check everything. You look into allegations out there about conspiracies. You don't get crazy because there's a lot of weird theories out there about the JFK assassination. So there's lots to cover in this next hour, but let me first have you talk about how you got interested in this and why. What made the JFK assassination stick out to you as a research topic?
Well, I remember the JFK assassination. Let me date myself. I was in kindergarten at the time, and I don't remember much about it, but I remember sitting around the family TV after that. So it's a memory. I didn't really get interested in it as a topic or something to be studied until 1983, which was the 20th anniversary of the assassination, and there was commentary, and at that point, I decided I want to know about this, so I started reading. But I didn't really get interested in it as a journalist until 1992. And that was the year Oliver Stone's movie came out. And it was also the year that, because of Stone's movie, the government began releasing records related to the assassination from the various investigations that had long been secret. And so, as a journalist, I mean, I was interested in the story, but I felt like I never had anything new to say about it because it had been, it had been so well covered. But in 1992 and after, these new records started to come into public view, and I thought there would be good stories in there. I knew a lot about the CIA. I had covered the CIA in the 80s for The Nation and The New Republic. I'd written about the role of the CIA in the civil wars in Central America. I'd written about the role of the CIA in the Iran-Contra scandal. So I knew how the agency was organized. I knew how to read its internal communications. I knew about some of its leading personalities. I knew something about its history. And I thought that when these JFK records became public, that there would be stories in there. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I started diving in. And sure enough, there were lots of stories. These were records that had been kept secret since the Warren Commission or since the congressional investigations of the 1970s. And so there was a lot of new information that came on the record. And I thought that was going to, deepen and clarify our understanding of the assassination. And that is indeed what has happened. So I started finding stories in these new records and started, writing about them. So I went into the new JFK records not with the idea of vindicating or refuting any conspiracy theory, but with the idea of finding new stories about the events that led to the assassination. What did CIA officers know about Oswald? What did they think about the assassination afterwards? Those were the kind of things that I thought would be in there. And indeed, that is what I found. So starting in the 1990s, we came to have a whole new body of records about the JFK assassination. And that's really what I've been working in.
Let me start with the Warren Commission and later the Assassination Review Board. I mean, obviously, Oliver Stone's movie created a renewed public interest, not only for you personally, but the public as a whole. Those investigations are highly criticized by the public as not being accurate. What are your thoughts on that? Was the Warren Commission spot on or full of holes?
The Warren Commission was set up in a moment of national crisis and deep fear that the assassination of Kennedy might lead to war between the United States and the Soviet Union or the United States and Cuba. This was just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the world had come as close as it's ever come to nuclear war. So the Warren Commission was set up for the purposes of reassuring the public and damage control. It was not set up for the purposes of fact-finding. And as we now know, there was a whole lot that the Warren Commission never knew about the events leading up to the assassination. And I think this is one thing that I and others have found in the records that have been released since in the 1990s. And I tell the story in my recent book, The Ghost, the biography of James Angleton. And the story is this, the story that the Warren Commission never knew, which was Lee Harvey Oswald was monitored very carefully by the CIA from November 1959 to November 1963. Wherever he went, the CIA took notice of his movements. They were interested in his foreign contacts. They were interested in his politics. They were interested in his personal life. And all of this information over those 4 years was funneled into the office of James Angleton. None of this was known to the Warren Commission. So a very highly significant aspect of the story was simply unknown to the Warren Commission, and the result was they got the story wrong. The Warren Commission concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was this guy who came out of nowhere and shot the president for no reason. Okay, the first part of that statement we now know is false. Mm-hmm. Lee Harvey Oswald did not come out of nowhere. He was well known to senior CIA officials who, in fact, talked about him and thought about him just 6 weeks before the assassination. So that fact alone means that the Warren Commission is simply not accurate. The other thing that the Warren Commission did not know was about the CIA's plots to assassinate Fidel Castro, which were ongoing in November 1963. And so the commission never learned about this until 15 years later when it was made public. So that was another thing that the Warren Commission did not know. So the Warren Commission is simply, it's just not very accurate. It's not very well informed based on what we now know. So, you know, was the Warren Commission set up deliberately to tell a false story? I think that's simplistic. I think that there was a strong incentive on the commission to affirm the story that was put out by the Dallas police and the FBI that Kennedy had been killed by one man alone for no reason. That was the politically convenient solution. Mm-hmm. Nobody was at fault. It was just this guy who did it. Now, with the perspective of time, we can see that was the commission was very eager to reach that conclusion as opposed to developing a whole record of what had happened and then deciding what the conclusion was. And since the commission didn't know highly relevant facts, that the CIA knew all about Oswald, that the CIA was plotting to kill Castro, there was no way it could come to an accurate description of what had happened, and that they did not. So the Warren Commission, we now know, is not accurate. Lee Harvey Oswald did not come out of nowhere. Whatever happened in Dealey Plaza, the story that this guy was a loner and unknown to the U.S. government is simply false. He was very well known. So that's where, that was kind of became a, I was skeptical about the Warren Commission going in, and my research in the new JFK record showed that that skepticism was entirely warranted. The commission did not have the relevant facts, so they couldn't come to a relevant conclusion.
Now, that doesn't sound like anything that they would need to cover up. I mean, if they were watching him, what's the secret behind that? Why do you feel that the Warren Commission was not given all of that information to make a viable conclusion?
My suspicion, and this is the subject of my next book, the question was somebody in the CIA running an operation involving Oswald, and that the Warren Commission was kept in the dark because the CIA was protecting its sources and methods, which it does all the time. Mm-hmm. And so another thing that the Warren Commission did not know was that the CIA and FBI had targeted the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a pro-Castro organization which Oswald acted on behalf of. That committee, the FPCC, as it is known, was targeted for disruption by the CIA and FBI in the fall of 1963. So the accused assassin is a member of a group that the CIA is targeting for disruption, harassment, destruction. Mm-hmm. And the CIA and FBI don't tell this to the Warren Commission. Well, you got to ask, if they're running operations against this group, if they're keeping it all a secret, maybe they were running an operation involving Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, would be something that the CIA could never admit. So that's where you begin to say, hey, you know, what was really going on here? You know, when I talk about the CIA officers who knew about Oswald before the assassination, the interesting thing to understand about them is that they were operations officers. They were not counterintelligence officers, for example, who were charged with assessing security threats. These were people who ran operations. And so, you know, if you have, and we now know that there were six CIA operations officers who reviewed communications about Oswald 6 weeks before the assassination. You know, if there were six operation officers from the Soviet Union mm-hmm. who reviewed information about Oswald 6 weeks before the assassination, we would say, well, maybe there was an operation going on,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think we should do the same thing with the CIA. These people were talking about, thinking about Oswald, and they were operations officers. Were they running an operation? Well, we don't have any proof of that, but if you look at the whole circumstances, it is not impossible that they were. So that's where I think we're at.
And the Assassination Review Board panel, obviously that came years later. Do you feel that they had more information, the same information? What do you think about that final report that they issued?
So the Assassination Records Review Board was created after Oliver Stone's movie, and it was created to implement the JFK Records Act of 1992. And the JFK Records Act of 1992, which was passed in response to Stone's movie, said the government will release all of its assassination-related records in their entirety. And that's how we'll clear the air and, you know, quell suspicion and doubt and speculation. And so the AARB was empowered by a very strong piece of legislation. The JFK Records Act is a remarkable open government record, piece of legislation. And what it did was it took the power to declassify records out of the hands of the agencies themselves mm-hmm. and put it in the hands of somebody else. And so the AARB released hundreds of thousands, millions of pages of records that the agencies didn't necessarily want to give up. So the AARB really did a heroic job in finishing or completing or approaching the completion of the record of the assassination, at least as it was held by the U.S. government. And so, you know, but the AARB was not an investigatory body. They were not charged with investigating the crime or coming to any conclusion about it. They were only charged with finding all government records and making them public. So we are now at the end of that process. The JFK Records Act said that all JFK records had to be made public immediately. The agencies could ask for certain materials to be postponed for reasons of national security, privacy, or whatever. But within 25 years, everything had to be made public. Well, that law was passed in October 1992. So fast forward 25 years, we're in October 2017, and we had this big release of JFK files last fall. President Trump gave a pass to the CIA and FBI. They were allowed to delay release of their records for six more months. And in April of this year, they released the last of their records, and some 15,000 new files came into the public record. But, and there's a big but here, Trump also gave the CIA and FBI permission to continue withholding a huge amount of material.
Mm-hmm.
And there are now some 15,000 documents that remain fully or partially redacted. That we still haven't seen, and according to the president's orders, we might not see until we won't see until 2021 at the earliest. So, the promise of the JFK Records Act and the Assassination Records Review Board, full disclosure, has unfortunately not been achieved. But that said, the AARB did a very good job and has created a much more complete record of the JFK assassination, which is why we can talk about it in much more detail and more, factual and granular way, because mm-hmm. we actually have a lot of the records now.
So before we get into the information that's still withheld and or redacted, let me talk about the documents that were released. What are your thoughts now on from October of 2017 to April of 2018? All of those hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages that they just kind of dumped to the public, did that change anything to the overall narrative of what really happened?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of significant material in there. But, you know, look, at this point, people are not going to be swayed by one piece of evidence. This is a huge story that people have had on their minds for a long time. And what, you know, what we're seeing sheds more light on the situation. You know, does it change your mind? I mean, I don't think it's going to change that many people's minds. I think that the picture that it discloses is one that people need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I was just saying. Oswald was watched much more carefully before the assassination than anybody ever knew. And the documentation is in the new files. So, for example, one of the memos that was released in last year was a memo about people whose mail was intercepted and opened under a CIA program called Lingual. And what Lingual did was they opened and copied all international correspondence. So, well, the memo surfaced, which showed that in November 11th, 1959, 2 weeks after Oswald went to the Soviet Union and said he wanted to become a Soviet citizen, the CIA put Oswald's name on the Lingual watch list, which meant if there were any letters addressed to or from him, they would be opened and copied and filed. So Oswald was under mail surveillance starting in November 1959. So, and Oswald, they didn't intercept any letters by Oswald, but they did intercept a bunch of letters from his mother. So they were paying close attention to him from that early date on. So that's, you know, that is a significant finding. A second item that surfaced was a routing slip on an FBI report about Oswald in the summer of 1962. Oswald returned from the Soviet Union in the summer of 1962. He had married a Russian woman, and he resettled in Fort Worth, Texas. The FBI went to interview him, and that interview has long been public. But what we found out now was that interview was sent to the CIA and, in fact, sent to James Angleton's office. Mm-hmm. So this senior people were paying attention to Oswald each step of the way. When he went to the Soviet Union, they started reading his mail. When he came back, they received the FBI reports on him. And in 1963, that focus of senior CIA officers on Oswald increases. And in September and October, Angleton's office is notified about Oswald's arrest in New Orleans. They're notified that he's showed up in Mexico City, possibly in contact with Soviet and Cuban intelligence officers. So he is an object of high-level attention, and that's what the new documents confirm. And there's no disputing this. There's no theory here. This is all factually documented by the CIA.
Now, you've mentioned James Angleton a couple of times. Obviously, you've written a book specifically on the man. Can you tell everybody who doesn't know who exactly James Angleton was?
Yeah, James Angleton was one of the founding formative personalities of the CIA in its early years. He was in the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. The OSS was America's first foreign intelligence service, and it evolved into, after the war, it evolved into the CIA. So Angleton was a star in the OSS. He was immediately became a senior official in the newly formed CIA. And in 1954, he became the chief of counterintelligence for the CIA, a very important position. Okay, intelligence gathering is espionage, covert action, that sort of, you know, offensive secret operations. Counterintelligence is the defensive aspect of secret intelligence. You're trying to prevent the other guy from penetrating or disrupting your operation.
Mm-hmm.
And Angleton, who was a brilliant figure, used his counterintelligence position to amass a great deal of power within the agency. He had the ability to run operations and look into other people's operations, really unlike any other CIA officer. So he was the one who created the lingual mail surveillance program that I just talked about. Mm-hmm. So he was a very powerful man by the late 1950s, and he remained in power until the mid-1970s when he was fired. So he's well known for searching for Soviet moles within the CIA. He was very close to the leaders of the Mossad and other Israeli intelligence figures. He was very involved in spying on Americans, the mail surveillance program, and also spying on the anti-war movement. So he was a very senior CIA figure who operated at the margins of the law and amassed a great deal of power and was largely unaccountable even within the CIA. So Angleton had a staff of 200, which was really like a CIA within the CIA.
Wow.
So I wrote a book about him because he was a very important figure, and he also foreshadowed this concern that we have today about, you know, a deep state, about people operating behind the scenes, off the books. Well, Angleton was a very powerful figure in the U.S. government and was very unaccountable to anybody. And so he is a good case study in how the CIA came to be what it is today. He was very influential in its early days, and he's a good, a useful person to understand how the CIA grew over those years from the 40s to the 70s.
Being such a powerful guy, obviously with 200 people under him that he was, it sounds like, in charge of, but obviously he was pretty powerful. Is there something to be said that the information regarding Oswald prior to the assassination of JFK wound up on his desk? Or is that just
Absolutely.
Kind of the norm?
I mean, there's no question that all the information about Oswald wound up was being funneled to his office. The nature of the interest was Oswald was obviously, as a defector to the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. he was a person of counterintelligence concern, right? Had he been spying for the Soviet Union before he went? I mean, these are the obvious questions that you would ask about such a person. So, mm-hmm. you know, Angleton's interest in Oswald was quite understandable because he was a real counterintelligence issue, and that was true when he returned as well. What's interesting about Angleton's handling of Oswald is he admits nothing after the assassination. He doesn't tell the Warren Commission about what he knows about Oswald or why he was interested in him. That is kept entirely secret. One of the new documents that has surfaced is a memo in which Angleton tells an aide, when the Warren Commission comes asking questions about, you know, what did you know about Oswald's trip to Mexico City? And Angleton's aide writes a note and says, you know, Jim would prefer to wait out the commission on this issue. Well, why would a senior CIA official want to wait out mm-hmm. the investigation of a presidential assassination? That wording is very suspicious. And so you have to wonder, were they hiding something that, you know, they didn't want to share with investigators? And indeed, we know now that they were hiding a great deal. They were hiding all that they knew about him.
So what exactly? Sorry, I was just going to ask, why do you think that was written, where he just wanted to wait him out then? Do you have a theory on exactly what they are hiding other than sources and methods that you talked about?
I think that they're hiding. There was an operation to use Oswald for intelligence purposes, mm-hmm. which senior officials knew about and could never admit after the assassination. So, and the purpose of that operation seems to have been part of this targeting of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, that the operation against Oswald, or involving Oswald, was designed to harm the biggest group of Castro supporters in the United States, which mm-hmm. was very much resented by the CIA and FBI men at the time. So I think what the records show, and we don't have all the records, it's worth remembering, but I think what the new records show is that there was a CIA operation involving Oswald before the Kennedy assassination. Now, was that operation part of a conspiracy to kill the president?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's more speculative, but I try to stick with stuff that I'm like pretty sure I know and can back up mm-hmm. with solid evidence and multiple credible sources. So I think the idea that there was an operation involving Oswald, targeting Oswald before Kennedy's assassination, I think the documentary basis for that is very strong. Whether that was part of an operation to kill the president, that you can speculate in that direction.
Sure.
I don't see direct evidence of that.
Do you dismiss that possibility, though, that the CIA played a role? I mean, that's obviously in the grander picture of the conspiracy theory.
No, I don't. And I think what we have learned from the new records and what we learn from the continuing withholding of thousands mm-hmm. of JFK records is that the CIA has something to hide here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have something they don't want to share, and that is somehow, you know, that could be incriminating in the assassination of the president. So, you know, and let me just point out a couple other things that you often hear. One is, nobody can keep a secret in Washington, right? This would have come out by now. It would have come out a long time ago. Well, wait a second, okay? We just had the latest JFK release. Congress said you have to release everything. The media paid attention. Everybody mm-hmm. was looking at it. And the CIA and FBI hung on to 15,000 different documents.
Yeah.
So they can keep a secret.
Yeah.
It's quite well demonstrated that they can keep a secret. So, you know, so I think that that's kind of complacent or naive to think, oh, this would have leaked out by now. You know, the fact is that if there was such an operation, that would be a very dire threat to the CIA's credibility today.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very damaging for the CIA to admit that today. So they have a stake in this thing, and their stake seems to be, we're not going to tell you the whole story. So as a reporter, I come to that and I say, well, if you're not going to tell me the whole story, I'm going to assume that there's a story there, and let's try and figure out what that story is.
Yeah.
So that's where my work is going.
I just find it incredibly strange that, not to beat the dead horse, but for decades, the CIA is withholding all of this information, that there's intelligence on Oswald, that he wasn't this guy that came out of nowhere. All of a sudden, we find that documented proof. It's starting to trickle out. And like you pointed out, now there's 15,000 plus documents and pages. I don't know. There's no page length at this point, right? Just to make sure that I'm giving accurate information of how much is still withheld.
There are 15,000 documents. This is according to the National Archives mm-hmm. JFK database. There are more than 15,000 documents in that collection which still contain redactions. So if you go in and look at those documents on your site or on Mary mm-hmm. Farrell, you will see on some of them the entire entire pages are blacked out.
Yeah.
And there's nothing there. In other pages, there might be one word blocked out, and it's the name of a CIA station in Paris. I mean, there's a lot of ridiculous withholding that goes on in these things, as well as the hiding of real secrets. So, but there are extensive redactions in the JFK records. So there are at least 15,000 records and maybe many more thousand pages of material that have never been seen by the public and can't be seen by the public today.
And that's what confuses me, just for the length of time that has passed. Yes, maybe it was an embarrassment that the CIA missed the fact that there was a plan to assassinate the president. That's a possibility, just to be fair. So I just don't understand, though, why so much is still withheld to this day and they won't tell us. And it just seems like years and years, already a generation has passed. I mean, not to age anybody who was alive at the time, but what I mean by that is there have been decades that have gone by. In my opinion, there's no reason to continue to withhold this. I get it. Some sources and methods should be, but
I think that's the commonsensical position. And so in fact, this continued withholding, I mean, it really gives the dispassionate observer no choice but to think that they're hiding something.
Yeah.
I mean, they are hiding something.
Yeah.
So, you know, given the passage of time, given the circumstances of the assassination, you have to wonder, are they really hiding something incriminating? And that possibility cannot be ruled out.
I've tried to rule it out, to be blatantly honest with you. As much as what I do with the Black Vault and going after government documents, and I'll go after records on any government secret you can think of, I do play devil's advocate and try and rule it out. And with this specific theory that there was some kind of government involvement, I can't rule it out. And to be honest with you, I thought come October 2017 through X amount of months of waiting for the remainder of the documents to come out, that everything was going to come out and it was going to be kind of a big letdown. And then, of course, you'd have the conspiracy theorists say, oh, well, they're hiding it or whatever. No, they just straight out tell you we are withholding all of this information, a lot of which is being held entirely up for a couple of years. And I'm a betting man. I would bet that in at least 2021, like you mentioned, that these documents are going to be withheld till something will happen that will then extend that time frame. Do you think that disclosure of all of this is even possible at this point?
Well, the experience with Trump was very disappointing because whatever else you think of President Trump, his hostility towards the intelligence agencies, his populist instinct, his own ridiculous and unfounded JFK conspiracy theory that he offered during the campaign, all of that created some aura of doubt that maybe he would order the CIA to release everything.
Yeah.
Now we realize that Mike Pompeo, the CIA director at the time, went to Trump, said, we could not possibly release all of this stuff. You got to give us a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump caved. And so we didn't get full disclosure. And those people who had hoped that Trump would release all the files were disappointed. And so I feel like, and now, so then they get a 6 month pass. Now they've continued to withhold 15,000 different documents. You know, if they rolled the president twice in 6 months and got away with it,
mm-hmm.
why wouldn't that happen again? So I'm with you. I doubt that this stuff is going to be made public, absent, you know, some outside pressure like Oliver Stone's movie or some outrage or, you know, something that creates some public pressure on, you know, the government to be more forthcoming. But right now, I don't see that happening. And I think, you know, secrecy remains the CIA's approach to the JFK story. That's,
yeah.
You know, there's no disputing that. And so, you know, draw your own conclusions.
And I feel that's a shame, but I also feel that that is a tactic of the government, not only with the JFK assassination, but many types of conspiracy allegations. Now, again, I'm not trying to be a crazy conspiracy theorist here, but I feel that the tactic would be let enough time pass, right? That's tactic number one. But part of that is also it allows the public to muddy the waters, meaning if we have a couple blanks, the public will just fill it in, you know, not based on anything. And that's why I invited you onto the show, was that you're into the documents, that you don't go into wild speculation. And I think that the public is its own worst enemy when it comes to getting to the truth, because they just fill in the blanks with whatever they can think up. And that muddies the water to the actual truth. So the government can just sit back, let the public bury itself into wild conspiracy claims. Then it becomes the majority of it is not true. So then people just stop caring. And I hate to say that, because this is such an amazing story and one I feel that does have a root in a big conspiracy and cover up. Now, conspiracy and cover up of what, we don't know. But I think that that is part of the game, in my opinion. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
No, it definitely is. And we know when it started. On April 1st, 1967, CIA Director Richard Helms issued a long memo called a book memo, which was sent to every CIA station in the world, with instructions for, and this is a quote, countering critics of the Warren Commission. And in this memo, Helms lays out for CIA officers everywhere, how do we counter critics of the Warren Commission? Now, there's one thing that's interesting to note about this. At that point, okay, there was a lot of skepticism about the Warren Commission already in 1967, four years after the assassination. But it didn't necessarily focus on the CIA, but the CIA took it upon itself to launch a secret campaign to discredit the critics of the Warren Commission and to dub them, quote, conspiracy theorists, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And the memo explains how to cultivate sympathetic allies in the media to promulgate this view that there's no basis for criticizing the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission consisted of great men who wouldn't possibly lie. These conspiracy theorists, cherry pick the evidence. And so the CIA lays out the game plan for saying criticism of what we now know was a flawed investigation are un-American, out of bounds, and should not be taken seriously by the news media. So the CIA launched that effort in 1967, and that is the game plan.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure that legitimate criticism is not taken seriously. So that's the stance that we're up against. You ask, is it possible? Well, as somebody who's investigating this, I'm sort of condemned to optimism. I mean, we've learned a hell of a lot more than we ever thought we would. We know a lot more than we knew when Oliver Stone's movie was put out. And so we have made progress, and we've still got a mass of information to go through. I mean, I certainly have not digested the material that's been released since October, and I'm one of the people who's most interested in this in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's still too early to tell even what we have learned in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
It's going to take time to go through all of that and figure out, is there something truly new here? But based on the types of records that are released, I think that, yes, I think, there are new things to be learned about the JFK assassination in 2018.
And that, I think, is also part of the tactic. And again, this is not just applicable to the JFK assassination records, but quite a few various topics where the government then will say, hey, we're releasing the information. Obviously, with this particular one, they withheld quite a bit. But hey, we're releasing the information. And then they dump out to you, a 500,000 to 1 million pages. And so even though, yes, they released it all by April of 2018, as you alluded to here, it's going to take years to truly digest it, understand it. Of course, we can kind of thumb through it and find the gems. But I think that that's part of that plan, where then ultimately you have hundreds of thousands or millions of pages to go through. Then it becomes so difficult to put the picture together, because these documents are not written like a book. That in itself, I believe, is also part of the game, where you just bury the public in information and let them try and figure it all out. Let me ask you some, I don't want to say they're public misconceptions, but they're very popular within public circles on theorizing what happened to JFK. And just to kind of jump and cut to the chase, one of those is Oswald did not act alone. With your expertise and research, what are your thoughts on him? Was he that lone gunman, even though he was watched? Did he act alone, or was there someone else?
I'm not convinced that Oswald fired the fatal shot. He might have fired a gun in Dealey Plaza, but I think that the evidence shows the president was ambushed by his enemies. And Oswald had some role in that, which is why he was killed while in police custody. I don't think Oswald alone was responsible for the assassination of the president. I don't think the evidence supports that conclusion.
Towards the end of the interview, we'll be opening up the TBV mailbag for listeners to this program who submitted some questions. But I'm going to actually throw one in here because it fits. Peter Robbins actually submitted a question about Oswald being a patsy. Do you believe that he was? Do you believe that he was complicit, at least in part? I think you partially answered that already. But specifically, can you talk to him being that patsy?
Well, Oswald's statement that he was a patsy is a remarkable one, because if it's true that Oswald alone killed the president, for nobody's ever established a very good motive, why wouldn't he take credit for it? I mean, why would he deny it? I mean, if Oswald was a lone nut like John Hinckley, the guy who shot President Reagan, who fit the definition of a lone nut, he was a loner and he was mentally disturbed. Lee Oswald was not a loner and he was not mentally disturbed. But, you know, Hinckley didn't deny that he shot Reagan, okay? Why would somebody who was making a bid for fame then turn around and deny that they had done it? So Oswald's statement that he was a patsy is significant. You know, I think that what we know now about how much the CIA knew about him and how he was manipulated, it's entirely possible that he was manipulated into being what he said he was, a patsy, a fall guy for a crime that he was not responsible for. So that's how I would answer Peter's question. You know, the idea that Oswald was a patsy is plausible.
And it's sad that we'll just never find out exactly what. I mean, and that I think fuels, for obvious reasons, a lot of these conspiracy theories that here he was saying that he was not taking credit. He didn't say, yeah, I did it for XYZ reason. He was taken out in a very short amount of, you know, a short amount of time. Now, you have sued the CIA in Morley v. CIA in the public case record. Can you talk a little bit about that lawsuit and what exactly you were going for?
Yeah, so when these new JFK records opened up, I came across the story of a CIA officer in Miami whose existence was previously unknown, who had been working with running, funding, advising an anti-Castro student group called the Cuban Student Directorate. And the Cuban Student Directorate had an interesting role in the assassination story, which was in August of 1963, when Oswald was going public as a supporter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, he was challenged by the Cuban Student Directorate in New Orleans. And as a result, because of the intervention of the Cuban Student Directorate, Oswald got a lot of publicity. He was on the radio. He was mentioned he was on TV. He was mentioned in newspaper articles. He got into a fight with the Cuban students. He was arrested. And so this, with the help of the Cuban Student Directorate, Oswald got a lot of publicity as a Castro supporter. Well, nobody ever told the Warren Commission that Oswald's antagonists among the anti-Castro Cubans had been funded by the CIA. And through some reporting in Miami, I figured out who that CIA officer was. And his name was George Joannides. He was a career CIA officer who died in 1990. I sought his records from the CIA to clarify this. And on exactly this point, which was Joannides using a CIA-funded group to target Oswald for, you know, some kind of political purpose. So I sued the CIA for the Joannides records, and I won twice. I got a big batch of documents in December of 2004, and I got another big batch in August of 2008. And what these records showed was Joannides was indeed running this group at the time. He was giving them lots and lots of money. They were very well funded. Joannides reported to Dick Helms, who was then the deputy director and later became the director of the CIA. Joannides, we learned through the litigation, had received one of the CIA's highest honors, a career intelligence medal. And we learned that Joannides had maintained a residence in New Orleans in the period 1962 to 1964. So Joannides, you know, the idea that he was manipulating Oswald or targeting Oswald, I mean, my case didn't prove it, but all the evidence we found suggested that that might well be the case. So that's the story that I have been pursuing, and the litigation continues to this day because the CIA wants to say, you know, Morley didn't find anything of public benefit as a result of this lawsuit. But usually in Freedom of Information Act litigation, if the plaintiff wins, right, over government, if the government is recalcitrant and doesn't provide the information, and the plaintiff then wins, the law holds that the government then pays the plaintiff's legal costs, mm-hmm. and it's a common sense incentive for the government to follow the law. They can't withhold information capriciously, because if they do and they get shot down in court, then it's going to come out of their budget.
Mm-hmm.
So I won in court, but the CIA is not going to admit that I found anything. So they're fighting me on the question of whether there's any public benefit. This question has gone to the D.C. Court of Appeals four times, and I won three times. And the fourth time happened earlier this month on July 9th when the court ruled against me. And the person who wrote the decision was Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who was nominated for the Supreme Court later that day after ruling against me. So this issue is still a live issue in the federal courts, and I am going to appeal. One of the judges, it was a split decision, 2-1. One of the judges issued a dissent, Judge Karen Henderson, very strongly in my favor, mm-hmm. and said that I had produced significant public information of public benefit and that I deserve to have my legal fees paid. So on that basis, I am appealing and continuing to file. Naturally, the CIA does not want to go on the record saying Morley found something of benefit,
mm-hmm.
which I think tells you that this story is important, because they are trying to get rid of it by fighting me in court. So that's the story of my lawsuit, and it continues. It goes on.
So a quick point to listeners of the Black Vault Radio. A couple episodes ago, I had brought up Brett Kavanaugh in a decision that he had written on the side of secrecy, covering up the CIA's release on a historical narrative of the Bay of Pigs event.
Yes.
And this wasn't planned, but it's pretty fascinating to hear that within an episode or two, Kavanaugh yet again played a role in deciding of on the side of secrecy to withhold documents and or in your case not give you what is in my mind legally your right. But let me ask you just kind of an ignorant question. You had said you had won this a couple of times. How does that work from a legal standpoint? If you won once, doesn't that mean you won? How does that work?
No, well, so what happened was the district court judge dismissed the case, mm-hmm. and said the CIA doesn't have to pay legal fees. So I appealed to the to the D.C. Court of Appeals, and they ruled that the Judge Richard Leon, had applied the law incorrectly in his decision. So the appellate court does not hand down a decision, but they give the decision back to the judge who heard the case originally. So the appellate court ruled in my favor and asked Judge Leon to rule again. Well, Judge Leon came up with a bunch of different pro-CIA arguments and ruled against me. I appealed again. I went to the appellate court. I won again. And they said Judge Leon has again applied the law incorrectly. And they sent it back to him. So that happened three times, and I won three times. The CIA, but Judge Leon kept ruling against me. So this came up a fourth time this year. We had the hearing in March that Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Henderson heard, and they ruled a fourth time. So that's why I didn't win, because the district court judge would not follow the obvious suggestion of the appellate court to award me court fees. So
it's mind-boggling to be I'm not a lawyer, but it's just it's amazing to hear.
It is a staggering waste of the court's time. It's an abuse of clear precedent in the Freedom of Information Act. And Judge Karen Henderson, you can find this on my website, Judge Karen Henderson's decision is quite eloquent about just how bogus Kavanaugh's argument against this is. I mean, she really dismantles the argument and says this has no basis in law, and Morley clearly deserves to have his legal fees paid. And by the way, Judge Karen Henderson is very conservative, so this is not a political issue. She was appointed by President Reagan, appointed to the appellate court by President Bush. She is very, in her rulings, she is a classic social conservative, and she found very clearly in my favor.
Sounds like she should have been the Supreme Court state pick by Trump, but be that as it may, is it public record, if you don't mind me asking this, how much court fees you are going for that they are denying? Can you say? And it's okay if you can't.
I mean, you know, we've talked about a ballpark figure of $150,000, but that is, you know, that was before this latest round, so my lawyer has put in a lot more time.
Sure.
And these things are subject to negotiation. You know, believe me, we're not out to make money.
Sure.
Okay?
No, no, no.
We're out to have the law respected, and, you know, and they don't do it. It's a six-figure sum. I mean,
yeah.
this litigation has been going on for 15 years. So I've done
nine
declarations.
Yeah, here's the reason why I was asking was not trying to say, hey, you're trying to make money. On the contrary, I'm surprised it's that low, to be blatantly honest with you.
Yeah.
But my question then, with the attorney fees, how much money do you think the courts and taxpayer money went to fighting you on that? Meaning, is it five times probably what you guys are asking for over the course of however long that this has taken place?
Absolutely. I mean, when we went into that courtroom in March and I looked over at the defendant's table, there were six attorneys from the Justice Department and the CIA. Every one of those attorneys, I assure you, makes a six-figure salary, right?
Yeah.
And they were spending, all of them were spending a half day in court. They had written briefs about this. They had responded to my briefs about this. But yes, they have put in a huge amount of money. It's a tremendous waste of, the government's resources. It's a waste of the court's time. You know, they call the D.C. Appellate Court the second highest court in the land. I mean, these courts handle the most important issues of public policy.
Yeah.
And as important as the Kennedy assassination is, it's not that important. It should have been disposed of much more efficiently.
Yeah.
And they didn't do it. And they didn't do it because they don't want to come clean.
It sounds from a legal standpoint, again, I am no attorney, but you have earned that reimbursement. Legally, it should be yours. It's kind of an atrocity that they're doing that. And again, my overall point with that question was how much money they are spending to fight that dollar amount. They're spending 5-10 times that, which is pretty ridiculous. So Jefferson, in the last 7-8 minutes that I got you here for our interview, I want to open up the TBV mailbag. And then at the end, I do want to briefly talk about your new blog on the deep state, because I know that you've been working hard on that recently. But here are some of the questions, the top 4 or 5 questions here, some of which we've covered already. So I'm just going to kind of skip those. But I do want to get to some audience question. Now, this one was specifically submitted by Andrew Hall. Now, Andrew asks, is it true that JFK had plans to abolish the CIA?
I mean, let me answer that. President Kennedy was very skeptical about the CIA. And after the failed invasion at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961, an invasion organized by the CIA and defeated by Fidel Castro, a real embarrassment for Kennedy in his first 100 days in office. Kennedy privately chastised himself for believing in the CIA, and at one point he said, I should splinter it into 1,000 pieces and cast it to the wind. So he didn't have a plan to abolish the CIA, but he did consider the idea of curbing it, and he was very skeptical about its claims and pressure. So he was not out to abolish it, but there were times when he contemplated that, and his relationship with the CIA was tense because he did not trust them. So that's how I would answer the question about abolition.
I'll let the audience decide. I mean, that to me, with what you just said, could obviously play into some kind of motive. Let's say that there is some truth to a CIA connection to all of this. Here's another question. This specific one is from Allison in Rhode Island. She says, the journalist Russ Baker, in his book Family of Secrets about the Bush family, brings up a little-known coincidence that Abraham Zapruder worked as head cutter in the sportswear design and manufacturing company of the wife of Oswald's supposed CIA handler, and I might not have this pronounced correctly, George de Morenschildt. This is one of those coincidences in the JFK assassination event, which has always struck me as very odd. May I ask your opinion on this? Thanks very much.
I don't think that the de Morenschildt connection to Zapruder is anything other than coincidental.
Okay.
But de Morenschildt is an important figure because de Morenschildt was an informal source for the CIA, and he was directed to befriend Oswald in Dallas in the fall of 1962 by the local CIA representative. So George de Morenschildt was a eyes and ears of the CIA on Oswald in late 1962 and early 1963. Another fact that was not disclosed to the Warren Commission. So George de Morenschildt is important, and it's important to remember, too, that George de Morenschildt testified to the Warren Commission and basically said he thought Oswald was guilty, or that's the way his testimony appeared in the Warren Commission. George de Morenschildt felt very guilty about that because he liked Oswald, and later in life, in the 1970s, he concluded that Oswald had not killed the president, and he wrote a book saying that, and that book has now been published by the University of Kansas Press called Lee Harvey Oswald as I Knew Him, and in it, George de Morenschildt describes his friendship with Oswald, and it's a very interesting book. It's the most realistic portrait, unbiased portrait we have of Oswald, and I think that, you know, that is important, and that's why George de Morenschildt is important.
Okay.
So he's a true source, and his story is very interesting, and it undermines the official story.
And last, I'm just going to jump to the end here, because overwhelmingly, this was the most popular question submitted by quite a few different people. Some shout-outs to those who submitted a variation of this question include Stephen Padilla, Mustafa Azeen, Timmy 1963 from Northern California, and a couple anonymous submitters emailed this or a variation of this question in. There is a theory that there's a connection behind the JFK assassination and his desire to release UFO-related information. In your research, do you find any truth to that rumor at all?
No, none.
Okay.
None whatsoever. I mean, it is true that President Kennedy was interested in the UFO research that the government was doing, but there's nothing in the circumstances of the assassination or the investigation to suggest that that was a motive of anybody who was involved in the assassination or the cover-up.
Very good. Thank you for that. And thank you all for submitting your questions. Make sure you subscribe to the Black Vault for announcements on future guests. And I will send out requests for questions just like that. And we'll go over them on the show in future episodes. Now, Jefferson, before I lose you here as we approach the end of the hour, I know that this is a show in itself, and hopefully you had fun this hour, and we'll come back and speak to this more in depth. But I know that you've got a new blog on the deep state. Can you talk a little bit about what you are now doing with that?
Yeah, so I am going to launch a blog in the fall. I'm developing it now, called The Deep State. And the purpose of the blog is to cover intelligence agencies worldwide, the 15 largest intelligence agencies in the world. These agencies have tremendous influence on our country and on the lives of other countries. And the way that they exercise their influence is not well understood. Hence this term, the deep state, which is heard quite often now. So I want to try and shine light on secret intelligence agencies and how they operate in the United States and other countries, try and educate people, fact check some of the claims that are made about the deep state and about intelligence agencies, and also do original reporting on what these secret services do. So the deep state will aggregate news about intelligence affairs. It will provide original reporting, and it will provide a wide range of debate about what is going on in this world. And it will do fact-checking to shoot down, bogus conspiracy theories or to confirm conspiracy theories that, in fact, happen to be true. which doesn't have a partisan bias. It doesn't have an ideological agenda, except to say that we need to take on these secret agencies and hold them accountable. So the purpose of the Deep State blog is to hold intelligence agencies accountable and to educate the public about how they operate. The editorial philosophy will be the same at JFK Facts, a real focus on empirical evidence, sifting good evidence from bad, encouraging a wide range of civil debate so that people can understand these issues, and hopefully educating the next generation about how these secret services work.
Very good. I'm looking forward to that. Again, you can reach Jefferson online at www.jfkfacts.org. And I hope he will be back to talk a little bit more about the deep state, because that in itself, like I said, is very much a full episode.
I would love to do that when we launch in the fall, John.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun, pretty informative. I've learned quite a few things. I hope all of you that have been listening have learned some things as well. But Jefferson, thank you so much, and I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Yep, and my pleasure. Anytime. Although that concludes my interview with Jefferson Morley, don't go away. Coming up, I'll tell you about a trip to a presidential library in search of documents. And I got way more than I bargained for. That's next on this episode's TBV Unredacted. In this episode's TBV Unredacted, I'm staying with the theme of the JFK assassination, or at least JFK anyway, and talk a little bit about his connection to UFOs. Now, I'm going to say that I do agree with Jefferson Morley when you all submitted a question in the TBV mailbag segment. In fact, quite a few of you submitted a variation of that question in which you wanted me to ask Jefferson about the allegation that JFK was going to disclose UFO secrets, that possibly playing a role in his assassination. Now, Jefferson shot that down, and rightfully so. I've never felt that that really was part of the conspiracy or the allegation on why that he was assassinated. So I have no disagreement on that one with Jefferson. But the reason why in TBV Unredacted I want to speak about UFOs is a little story that I very rarely get to tell. And I thought this radio program would be a great way and excuse to tell this story. Now, I've mentioned a couple times throughout various episodes about my work in television. That work has allowed me to do research and devote time to that research that normally I wouldn't be able to do. And one of the first television shows that I ever played a role in creating, I ended up being credited as what's called an associate producer. I had helped develop the concept and create the idea for a show for the History Channel called UFOs in the White House. Now, UFOs in the White House was a lot of fun to do, and the short premise to it was an expose on the UFO connection between United States presidents and the UFO phenomena. We began with FDR, and we went all the way to, at the time, present-day George W. Bush. Yes, it was that long ago that I actually created this program. And I got to do quite a bit of research. We, again, dove into every presidential administration, trying to figure out what that UFO connection was, or, you know, what type of documents there were. We really tried to stay rooted in history, but sadly, there was quite a bit that we had to get away from the documented history, a little bit more speculative, but at least we tried to find evidence along the way. Now, one particular era that we dealt with was John F. Kennedy. And during the course of my research, which was my job on the show, which was to bring all of the real documents forward, that was really the ultimate goal, was to do documents first. And then if we got into a little bit more speculative, that was secondary. And so I was asked to fly out to the John F. Kennedy Library, the presidential library. And if any of you have had a chance to visit one, it doesn't take politics out of it. It doesn't matter. Go. Look at it, see what's there, try and just do some research, look at the exhibits. again, politics aside, these presidential libraries give an amazing historical look at a presidential administration and the president himself. And this library was a treat for me to go to because obviously I have a special connection. It's something that I've researched a lot. I'm drawn to the story about Kennedy's assassination. But that's not why I was there, although that's what kind of played a role in me being very, very interested in going. But then once I was there, incredibly happy that I went because it was one of my first experiences at a presidential library. Now, why do I bring up this story? Well, for this show, I was looking for UFO documents, and part of the presidential libraries, as the majority of them are run by the National Archives, the role behind a presidential library is to offer just that, a library. Now, obviously, there's the public exhibits. You can go see what that particular president accomplished, what they did, and so on. But behind the scenes, or at least it's kind of behind the scenes, you can still access it. You just got to want to. That's the document part. The textual reference branches where you can go in and actually go through the original presidential documents. Now, I'm telling you, this is a treat. If you've never done it and you're a researcher and you like research, go do it. Pick something. Doesn't even matter. UFOs or not, assassination or not, it doesn't matter. Go research something because to go through the original documents is something that it's very hard for me to explain. Just because my love for history to see the actual records, not photocopies, not 70th generation photocopies that we sometimes get under the FOIA, but the actual originals. And so I had discovered that there was a box of UFO-related material within the archives of the JFK Library. And so that's why the main producer of this particular episode flew me out there, and it was my job to kind of figure out what was in there. Now, there was nothing earth-shattering, meaning, you know, an alien finger fell out of the box or anything. But what was amazing to me was when I opened these boxes and started going through the documents, one of the first ones I came across was a handwritten letter by Robert Kennedy. Now, working on John's behalf, he responded individually to every UFO letter, at least that I saw anyway, that the JFK administration received regarding UFOs. And Robert Kennedy came in and he would respond on his behalf, on John's behalf, and write these letters. Some were typed, and I came across this original one. These were, again, not photocopies, that Robert Kennedy had written. Now, to hold a document like that in your hand, that Robert F. Kennedy, and later I found one written by John F. Kennedy, when you hold it in your hand, it is an experience that I can't really explain. And a lot of those have been pulled from the archives, meaning because of that immense historical value, they pull them out and they will replace it with a photocopy. Those are kind of the rare exceptions when you'll stumble on actual photocopies. However, these were overlooked. And that just kind of shows you how much material that these presidential archives have. And how much is there for you to look at. So I kind of held this in my hand for a couple minutes and then just kind of took it in that, you know, Robert F. Kennedy actually hand wrote this thing. Another document, like I said, was signed by John F. Kennedy. So to hold those in your hand, it's amazing. Now, as a quick note, I did tell the archivist that those were in there. And very thankfully, they said that they were going to pull them and replace them with photocopies because, again, those are of immense historical value. Now, what were the documents? Well, this is what was interesting was that Robert F. Kennedy did respond to all of these UFO inquiries. Now, one particular one that I'm just going to highlight for you was written by, the original letter was written by a Ralph Ranko, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that specifically. Now, through research, I determined that he was part of NICAP, and that was the older UFO research organization, stood for National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. And Ralph Ranko, his letterhead was photographic illustrations, meaning he was a photographer from New York. And he was writing Senator Robert Kennedy and also President John F. Kennedy about UFOs and was sending information. And sure enough, Robert Kennedy on John's behalf was responding as well to these inquiries. And it wasn't just once. You can actually see from these documents that they were trading letters back and forth. And I took a photocopy of that handwritten RFK letter that he wrote. And the way he did it was Ralph had responded to Kennedy's response. So again, it was this back and forth where Kennedy said, hey, I had not seen this book. It was called The UFO Evidence. And Mr. Ranko was looking for Kennedy's reaction to this book called The UFO Evidence. And he had never seen it. So Robert Ranko actually sent it to him. Ralph Ranko actually sent it to Robert Kennedy. And Kennedy then took the time to respond yet again, this time a handwritten letter. He wrote it on the photocopy of his original letter. I'll read it to you. And again, this is handwritten, so I might stumble here just because it's a little bit messy. And there's some crossouts that Robert Kennedy had crossed out as he was writing. But he says, "Dear Mr. Ranko, thank you for sending me a copy of the UFO Evidence, published by the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. It is a detailed collection of reports on this visual phenomena. The book appears to be quite thorough. Based on information available to me from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the Air Force, I do not believe that a congressional hearing on this subject would serve a useful purpose at this time. You may, however, wish to write to the Senator Clinton B. Anderson, Chairman of the Senate Committee on Aeronautical and Space Sciences, to inform him of your interest in hearings on this subject. Sincerely, RFK." Now, again, that was handwritten. There's some crossouts in there, so forgive my stumble through. But I wanted to read the original document as I had received it as he wrote it. And I actually collected over 120 pages of material from the JFK Library, photocopied them all for this television program, and brought them back. And I wanted to profile this specific letter because, number one, it actually never made it into the television program I produced. For no other reason other than it's a very cool piece of history, but it didn't help with our particular story for that. But I thought I would profile it here for TBV Unredacted because it showed that during Kennedy's administration, with the help of Robert F. Kennedy as well, they took the UFO topic seriously. Now, this specific letter was written around 1965. This was about 4 years off, close to 5 years off, when the Air Force was about to close their official investigation. But at this time, the administration was still taking it seriously enough to handwrite these responses and have back and forths with UFO investigators, specifically in this instance, one from NICAP, talking about UFO books, congressional hearings, and so on. That's an amazing look into history. I don't know anybody who trades letters back and forth with Trump or Obama or any of their aides back and forth about UFOs, or at all for that matter. I wish politicians were a little bit more communicative with all of us, but be that as it may, I wanted to talk about those letters and the story that it took for me to get them. I flew back. Some of the documents made it in. Obviously, this one did not. I thought I would profile it. I will link this into the show notes so you can download. It's 127 pages in total that you can read through. These are straight from the Presidential Library of John F. Kennedy. I do not believe some of these had ever seen the light of day. Some had at this point. I received these back circa 97, 98. 1998 was when I was actually flown out there. So it was quite a while ago. And again, some of these had never been pulled before. So these were brand new in the sense that they had never seen sunshine and were never held by the hands of the public. So definitely worthwhile. All of that being said, thank you guys so much for listening to the Black Vault Radio. I hope you had a great time listening, learned some stuff from Mr. Jefferson Morley. He was a great interview and is somebody I could definitely talk to for quite a few hours, let alone the hour that we had with him today. So make sure you tune in next time on the Black Vault Radio. Log on, subscribe, check out the social network feeds, but also iTunes, Google Play, all of those places to subscribe to this channel. Get notified the moment these shows drop online. You don't want to miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.